Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Welcome to the Tucker Carlson Podcast. In this episode, Tucker dives deep into a provocative discussion with Matt Walsh, tackling the controversial topic of gay adoption and surrogacy. They explore the perspectives of social conservatives and the challenges they face within the broader conservative movement. This candid conversation promises to challenge conventional views and spark debate. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
Okay, so I'm not on X all that much, but I do read you. And sometimes I read your tweets and I'm like, Matt Walsh, ladies and gentlemen, spinning people up. Here's one. We've been saying for many years that gay adoption and surrogacy should be illegal. Now everyone else seems to be catching on. This is an abomination. We've been saying for many years that gay adoption is an abomination. I've never heard anybody say that.
Wow, we're just diving right in.
We're diving right in.
Gay adoption is an abomination. Yeah, well, I think there I was referring to social conservatives, because social conservatives still somehow get a bad rap. So, you know, so-called social conservatives, even among other conservatives and other people on the right, it seems to me. But so when I say we, I mean like so-called social conservatives.
I've never heard them say that. I've never heard anybody. I think I agree with it, what you said, but I'm not. I don't think I've ever heard a single person say that. Everyone seems to be afraid to say that.
Yeah, most people are. That's why I think, but you know, so-called social conservatism is that's why it's not popular even on the right.
Can I ask you about, is there anything more hated on the right than social conservatism?
I don't think so.
So you could say, like, I think we should drop an atomic bomb on a bunch of people and just, like, kill them all and their kids. And people are like, well, that's a really good idea. But if you're like, actually, we should, like, save some kids, then they hate you. What is that?
Yeah. Or we should look at the way that human society was structured for thousands of years. And we should probably consider that they were right about a lot of that stuff. You know, maybe not everything.
Right.
Maybe not everything, but there are just certain basic civilizational truths that we have moved away from in recent decades. But I don't think there's any good reason to move away from them. And so if human beings did something a certain way for literally millennia in every civilization that we know of, it's probably right.
As we reflect on those enduring truths, it's interesting to consider how they intersect with contemporary issues surrounding identity and acceptance.
You know, gays aren't going to break into your house and, you know, forcibly make you gay or something. Like, why do you care? And I thought that, you know, kind of made sense to me at the time. There's a sense that's just not true, actually, that it did have a big effect on everybody else. Do you think that?
It certainly did, because it's always a lie, obviously, when they say, oh, this isn't, we just want to do what we want to do and we're not, it won't affect you and we don't need you to be involved. This is just what we're doing in the privacy of our own homes.
That was a good argument, though, don't you think?
In theory, in principle, it's a good
argument. I'm just saying as a kind of matter of slogans, you know, like that's better than just do it for Nike or have a Coke and a smile. That's like a really effective ad campaign for Americans, because that matches the American instinct, like, you know, live and let live.
And there's a certain, it makes sense to an extent that if someone across the street from me is in their home doing some freaky weird stuff, and that's it, they're just in their home doing it, and I never even know about it or see it, my children don't see it, my children don't know about it, then yeah, it's hard to make an argument that I'm somehow impacted by that. Because I'm not, except maybe in the most indirect sort of way. But that's not how it actually works. That's just the slogan. That's not what really happens.
Right.
And so we follow the trajectory, and we've seen this time and time again. It always starts with tolerance. They say, well, just tolerate this, which I guess we're supposed to think means, you know, it's just people are doing this on their own. You don't have to, you could just stay out of it and they'll stay away from you and yes. So tolerate it, right? Tolerance, so it starts there, but then it goes to very quickly acceptance. And then they start saying, well, you should accept this. Well, accept and tolerate are not exactly the same thing.
How are they different?
Well, tolerate means I just like put up with it.
I allow it.
I allow it. I put up with it. I don't try to stop it.
Right.
Is what tolerance means in the most literal sense. Accept means I'm embracing it.
Right.
You know, it means I'm embracing it. And, but then they don't stop at accepting. Because then they go to, well, okay, now actually we need you to celebrate it. You know, so it goes from tolerance to acceptance to celebration. And
pretty fast, actually.
Pretty fast. Yeah, I think there was a time when that process might have taken, you know, 10 years, and now it seems like it takes 10 minutes. So we went from decades ago, it was, hey, they're just in their private lives, in their own homes doing this, doesn't affect you, to now, well, they're literally marching in the street, you know, in leather bondage gear, like flaunting in front of confused children standing there.
Having sex on the street, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Engaged in sexual acts. And even worse than that, they're going into the school systems. They're putting this stuff in the school. They're trying to tell my kids, well, my kids aren't in the school system, but, you know, they're trying to tell our kids.
Do the authorities know your kids aren't in the school system?
Well, they do now. Yeah. I'm in Tennessee, so we still have that right in Tennessee so far. But then they start going into the school system, and they start promoting this. They start trying to tell our kids that you should also tolerate this and accept it and embrace it and celebrate it. What they're telling kids in school about homosexuality, for example, is not just biology. There's a moral message. They're giving them a moral message, and the moral message is, this is okay. There's nothing wrong with it. This is, you know, a gay couple is equal in every way to a straight couple. These are just different variations. You know, it's morally neutral. That's their message. That's ideology. That's not biology. And once you start doing that, then it's like very clear how this affects me, you know.
But how does it affect the society?
Well, it fundamentally transforms society and our basic priorities, how we live, what matters to us.
So we're not positive if cryptocurrency is the future of finance, but we do know that what we have now is broken and dangerous. Debt has never been higher in this country. Many of our so-called leaders are getting rich, serving you. It's a scam. So where does it go? Well, thankfully, there are options. Donald Trump has said repeatedly he wants the United States to be the crypto capital of the world. He's already created the Crypto Advisory Council and recently signed an executive order to establish a Bitcoin strategic reserve. This could give normal people an alternative to the government's failing system and, frankly, to the U.S. dollar. I'm not saying put all your money outside the U.S. dollar, but, like, don't be crazy. Don't be stupid here. You can see where it's going. So the people at iTrust Capital can help you get in to this. It's complicated for people who aren't following it. They make it easy. They're based 100% in the United States of America. We looked into this. They service only American investors, and they operate the only platform that allows you to buy and sell crypto 24/7, both inside and outside of your tax-advantaged IRA. And it all happens on one easy-to-use dashboard. They also operate a closed-loop system, meaning that bad actors can't access your account and steal your money.
As we shift gears from the world of crypto investments, let's dive into a personal story that highlights the struggles of financial hardship.
And the gas tank is empty. Because, like, when you're broke, your gas is always almost empty. And so I had no gas. I had insufficient funds. And I remember thinking, this is after I had two kids already. This is how broke we were. But I remember thinking, I'm going to have to ask someone at a gas station for money. I'm going to have to do this. I can't believe I'm going to have to. But I didn't. I just started looking under the chair for coins. And I found about like $1.50 in coins, and I went and paid for gas, $1.50 worth of gas in coins, enough to get home, and then we'll figure out the problem. But anyway, the point is we had no money. We were very broke. And, you know, money went a little bit farther back then, but not that much farther. I mean, this wasn't 50 years ago, right?
How many years ago was
this? This was 11 years ago.
Right. 11 years ago. All of us remember 11 years ago. It was same country.
Yeah, it was the same country. And we had, so we had one, we decided we wanted to have one income. We wanted to have a one income family. So family of four on one income. It was not a high income at all. It can be done. I think in most cases, you just have to be willing to make the sacrifices. And a lot of people aren't. And that's fine too, because you have to decide on what your priorities are. And so you might say, look, it's a priority to us that we, have a big enough house that each person can have their own room. We don't want to share rooms for kids. It's a priority to us that we have two cars, that we can go on vacation, a nice vacation once a year, that we can have two or three TVs, that everyone can have a smartphone with all the plans. And we want to have, you know, we want to have five different streaming subscriptions, and we want to be able to eat out whenever we want. Like, that's a priority to us. And okay, if that's a priority, then yeah, in a lot of cases, you're going to need double income. But if you're willing to say, okay, we're gonna downsize our home. We're gonna share bedrooms. We're gonna have one TV. We're gonna have one car. We're gonna go on much more modest vacations, and we're gonna cut things down to the bone a bit because it's worth it to us to be able to keep mom at home and to be able to homeschool or whatever it is. So I think if you're willing to say that, a lot of people could do it. But
do you think it is worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely.
Why?
100%. Because a lot of the other stuff doesn't matter, really.
And as we reflect on what truly matters in our lives, it's essential to consider how we shape our children's experiences.
There's no reason why they can't have it. My kids have that. I work in media, and yet my kids have exactly that kind of childhood because we just determined from the beginning that our kids are, they're going to have a real childhood. They are going to run outside and scrape their knees and climb trees. And that's what they're going to do. That's the kind of childhood they should have. And it is possible to have it. The only difference now is that it has to be a choice. You know, I think 30 years ago, that was just the default setting.
Well, more than a choice. I mean, you have to organize. Well, you're the one with six kids who are homeschooled. So you tell me, but it sounds from the outside like you have to reorganize your entire life around that goal.
You do.
It doesn't happen naturally, right?
Right. It doesn't happen naturally. That's why I said it has to be a priority. If it's an actual priority, if you really are lamenting that kids today don't have a real childhood, which I agree, I think that many of them don't. And I think it's a horrible tragedy. It really is. But if you really care about that and if it troubles you, then yeah, you have to make.
So what if you, I mean, if you don't mind, if this is too personal, just say stop being so creepy and I will pull back. But if you don't mind, like describe in specific terms the steps that you've taken to protect your children and allow them a childhood in a world that would deny them one. Like, what have you done?
Well, it starts with, but we don't send them to public school. You know, we have always homeschooled from the beginning. So that's a big step. They don't have phones. They don't have access to any screens except for our family TV. We have a family TV. There's a policy my wife and I have had since the beginning is we don't do screens. There will be no screens in a room that has a door on it. So we have one TV and it's in a very public area of the house where anyone can hear it when they walk in. And that's it. So we do have that. Like, our kids can watch TV. They can't watch it all day, but they can watch it. And we're going to know anything that they watch. You know, they're not going to just sit there on the TV and choose something. Tell us what you want to watch. If it's something I've never heard of, well, you're not watching that until I can watch it first. And they don't have any internet access at all. You know, no phones, no tablets, nothing like that.
Laptop.
No laptop. No computer at all. And our oldest kids are almost 12 now. The only exception we make is if we go on long car rides, which for us is 4 hours plus, then we have tablets that are for the car, 4 hour plus car ride. There's no internet on it. It's books and like educational games. And the tablets have that. And in the car, if it's 4+ hours, you can use those tablets. And then when we get to our destination, we're taking the tablets back. And I've And I've noticed this, that even this little bit of access to this, that kind of technology that we do give to our kids in the car in this really,
yeah,
in this really specific scenario, you see how this, it just has this pull on them.
Yeah.
And it becomes a, especially if it's one, you know, we sometimes go places, it's a 15-hour, 16-hour ride over a couple of days. So during that time, they do have the tablets for a while. And when we get there, it's almost like a detox.
Yeah,
they're just jonesing for
it's
the
like
tablet.
Giving them one jelly bean, they
right.
want more.
Exactly. And I had I've had to take what some people would consider extreme steps to get them over that.
how extreme?
Well, to me, it's not extreme because it's like what my dad would have done. But I remember it was last year, we had just come back from a long car ride, and so we took the tablets away, and then my son, it was 7 at the time. Freaked out, like he started screaming that he wanted his tablet.
Yeah,
and I said, you know, we're not that family. We don't have 7-year-olds screaming about tablets. We're not going to do that. And so I said, come here, bud, come over here. I brought him over to the where our trash can is in the kitchen, and I said, here's where the tablet's going. It's in the trash, and that's it. We're throwing it away. You're not getting it back.
Did he have a funeral for it?
Emotionally in his heart, he did.
Yes.
He was. Shocked. I mean, he was distraught. But we threw it away. I didn't give it back to him. It went in the trash. And like a year later, he got a new one for the car. And he freaked out. And about 10 minutes later, he was fine. And he was running around outside using a stick like a lightsaber or whatever.
But it shows you why most parents, despite, I think, wanting to do what you do, I do think a lot of parents will hear this and say, man, I would like to do that, or I should have done that. But the reason they don't is the pushback from the kids is really intense. Denying kids electronics, denying them what all of their peers, what all their friends have. Like it's hard.
It is hard. It is hard. And especially if it's easier. We have it a little bit easier because our kids are homeschooled and most of their friends are like homeschool Christian families. And most of them are on the same page. Not all of them, but most of them are. And it does make it easier. It certainly does. If your kid's in public school, it's going to be a lot harder because there's a whole culture, you know, that comes out of the screens, out of the devices. There's a language that comes out of it. And when I see one of my kids, like one of the 12-year-olds or the 8-year-old around one of their peers who are not part of the homeschool community, but just like a kid from public school or something, the difference is stark. It really is in every way. You can just, the way that they speak, like I said, they have a different language that they pick up. The way that they carry themselves. I think a lot of these kids are a lot more just sort of jaded and cynical. They seem a lot harder to impress. They're overstimulated.
Yes.
They're not interested in things outside of the screen.
As we delve deeper into the effects of this overstimulation, it's clear that the coping mechanisms have shifted dramatically.
Ladies are on benzos, the kids are on amphetamines, the young men are on weed.
Yeah.
Like, no one's in his right mind, but everybody's kind of grooving out to his own music, and testosterone levels have just like dropped through the floor, and so probably not going to have an insurrection when everyone's high. Right?
Yeah. It makes people compliant. It makes them apathetic even more than I think people just sort of naturally are these days. And of course, in reality, these are all bad things. So it kind of goes back to how has it made anyone's life better? And
right.
And I don't know. I'm a simple person. Maybe I can be guilty of being simplistic sometimes. So if that's the case, then guilty as charged. But to me, it's like, I think a policy is bad if it makes people's lives worse and doesn't improve anything.
What if it works in theory? What if it's a beautiful theory?
Well, theories are great. Then we can talk about it. Then it's a lot of fun to talk about.
It's like that famous, the De Gaulle line, which I think is probably fake. We know it works in practice. The question is, does it work in theory?
Yeah.
And you do feel like that's in operation in the United States. It's like, well, you know, people have the right to X, Y, or Z, therefore we're doing this. And it's like, actually, that's a disaster. But people have a right. You know what I mean? It's like, there's no reference point in reality there. It's just like the theory makes sense. Let's go with it.
Yeah. And that's why when people start talking about their rights, it doesn't mean a lot to me. I don't even know what people mean when they say it. You know, I'm not trying to be pedantic, but the next time someone says, well, I have a right to this, just ask them, well, what do you mean you have a right to it? What does that mean?
Oh, I know.
They really have no, they don't know what they're saying. I think the vast majority of people talking about their rights, if you ask them to define the word right, they would not be able to do it.
Or define anywhere. What's white supremacy? What's racism? What's anti-Semitism? What is any word used as a cudgel to make people be quiet and control them? Like, no one ever is forced to define what the term means.
Right.
In fact, there are even laws that I'm, you know, around those questions that are laws. They carry punishments, and the term is never defined.
Yeah.
I feel like this is a trend where language isn't used to communicate. It's used to control, and therefore it has to remain not fully defined.
Right. And that's why I think all I can do in response to that is if it's one of these terms that doesn't mean anything anymore.
As we shift our focus from the complexities of language and its implications, let's explore the powerful images of submission and humility that shape our values and beliefs.
But even he is showing submission and obedience and humility toward some power above him. I think that's a really powerful image for my kids to have, and that I had with my own dad growing up. So we do that. And I think this is also, I think I'm at the point where it's kind of like my whole ideology, my political ideology at this point is that I want my kids to go to heaven. I want my kids to go to heaven, and I want them to be good and happy people. That's what I want. So everything that we do in the home, and we're not perfect. We don't get this right perfectly, not even close to it, but everything we do in the home should be tailored towards that end, to help our kids be good and happy people. And that's also, those are the policies that I support. You know, those are my politics.
It sounds like Christian nationalism, Matt.
Guilty as charged. I'm a nationalist. I'm Christian. So
another term I have never heard defined. What an interesting way to frame it. What a great way to frame it. What do you think of as your duties as a husband and father?
I think it's provide. You know, we talked about gender roles. So I do believe that the father should be the provider in more ways than one. You know, you're providing financially, like bringing home the bacon is a really important part of that. And I think that the father should do that. But you're also providing safety, security.
You're protecting.
And I know when you say that, it sounds like, well, that's easy, because like what are the chances that I'm actually gonna have to fight off some bad guy that breaks into the house? It could happen. It's not impossible.
They're increasingly high, actually.
Yeah, increasingly high. But I haven't had to do it yet, and maybe I'll never have to do it. I hope I never have to do it. But it's not just about that. You know, as a man, you should be, I believe, a stabilizing presence to your family. Like when they're around you, they should just feel safer and calmer. And not necessarily because they're worried that a bad guy is going to, that's part of it, but it's not just that. Like the world's a confusing place. The world is a dark place. Everyone has anxieties. And when you're there, they should just feel calmer and better having you around. And if something goes wrong, if there's, the shit hits the fan, there's a problem, they should be able to know that, okay, well, thank God dad's here, or thank God my husband's here.
As we shift our focus from the complexities of support and reassurance in relationships, let's explore the freedom and opportunities that come with independence, especially for the younger generation.
Kids, you have no dependents. So you can it's very low stakes. You can go anywhere and try anything, right? Like you don't, if you're looking around and saying, well, there are no jobs in my town. I can't find any jobs. Go to a different town. Go anywhere. You can go, if you end up living in your car for a week or 2 months, it's not great. That sucks, but you can do that because it's just you. Now, for me, when I got six kids, so if things fall apart for me, it's much higher stakes. And it's not as simple as I can't just like go anywhere and try to do anything. At this point, I can't just like, okay, well, I'll go get a job at McDonald's. It's not going to work. I got all these kids to take care of. But for you, you can go anywhere and do anything and you can take risks. And if it doesn't work out, it'll be hard, but it won't be disastrous. So that's one thing. And that's your whatever your professional vocation is. But there's the personal vocation that I think for all men is the same, which is that every man is called to be a father. Every man. For most men, that will come in the form of biological fatherhood. Not all. There are other forms of fatherhood. There's spiritual fatherhood. I think some men are called to religious life. If you're Catholic, called to the priesthood. You don't get married, but you are still a father in a spiritual sense. But every man is called to fatherhood in some sense. No man is called to live for himself only and serve only himself. No man is called to live a life where they go to work, come home, play video games, have no one depending on them, no one that they love. No one is called to that life. So go and pursue that. You know, go pursue that and go pursue it fearlessly. And know what you're looking for and realize that there are a lot of women who are also looking for the same thing. I hear from conservative Christian men all the time saying, I'm conservative, I'm Christian, there are no good women left.
Yes.
There are no women out there who share my values.
Constantly you hear that.
But then I also hear from women all the time who are conservative Christians saying, I'm conservative, I'm Christian, there are no good men, there are no men who share my values. And I'm like, well, you know, you guys... You're both out there. You both exist. I know you're out there.
And while both sides express their frustrations about finding compatible partners, it's essential to recognize that taking risks in relationships is crucial.
Okay, we know that. But knowing all of that, you still like have to be courageous and just jump face first into it anyway. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, right?
Right. And especially when you have kids. Once you have kids, the possibility of tragedy it increases exponentially.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I mean, now you, because before it was like all the tragic things that can happen to you. Now it's what are all the tragic things that can happen to my kids?
Oh, yeah.
And then times that by however many kids you have.
Yeah.
And then you've got your wife, and it's like there are so many horrible ways that this could go.
Oh, yeah. And may.
Right. But then, if any of that happens, what's the end result? The end result is. Could be misery and despair. Okay. So then your solution is just to embrace misery and despair at the outset?
Yeah. Don't
because you're afraid that it might happen.
I agree.
I would rather, for me, if I'm going to end up miserable and in some tragic scenario, which I hope doesn't happen, I'd rather it be because I went out and like lived a life.
It's one of the saddest things about this country. The country's getting sicker. Despite all of our wealth and technology, Americans aren't doing well overall. Obesity, heart disease, autoimmune conditions, all kinds of horrible chronic illnesses, weird cancers are all on the rise. Probably a lot of reasons for this, but one of them definitely is Americans don't eat very well anymore. They don't eat real food. Instead, they eat industrial substitutes, and it's not good. It's time for something new, and that's where Masa chips come in. Masa has decided to revive real food by creating snacks, how they used to be made, how they're supposed to be made. A Masa chip has just 3 simple ingredients, not 117. 3. No seed oils, no artificial additives, just real delicious food. And I know this because we eat a ton of them in my house. And by the way, I feel great. So you can still continue to snack, but you can do it in a healthy way with chips. Without feeling guilty about it. Masa chips are delicious. They taste how a tortilla chip is supposed to taste. But the thing is, you can hit them really, really hard, and I have, and not feel bloated or sluggish after. You feel like you've done something decent for your body. You don't feel like you got a head injury, or you don't feel filled with guilt. You feel light and energetic. It's the kind of snack your grandparents ate. Worth bringing back. So you can go to masachips.com. Masa is M-A-S-A, by the way. masachips.com/Tucker to start snacking. Get 25% off. We enjoy them. You will too.
Well, you are going to end up miserable in some tragic scenario at some point. That's just a fact. Like, we shouldn't hide that from ourselves, actually. Like, that's something horrible is going to happen to you, for sure. You're going to get the diagnosis. Someone you love is going to get the diagnosis, or worse. And the whole point is, you know, your dad, you're not afraid.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you're running toward the sound of gunfire, not away from it. That's like your whole role.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's of all the unpopular messages that we've talked about, that's probably the most unpopular.
Why?
Is that, like, it's going to end in tragedy no matter what. We're all going to die. Like, we're all going to die.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. Yeah. Right. It's bad.
That's the thing that nobody wants to think about and talk about. We should probably think about it and talk about it a lot more than we do.
Oh, the more you think about it, the lighter you're bearing and the more cheerful you are. I was reading someone recently who said, you know, meditating on death every day is the most certain way to joy and cheerfulness and lightness. And I think that's right.
I kind of agree with that. I mean, I read a book. There's this, there was a book that was written years ago called Denial of Death. You ever read that?
No.
And I'm blanking on the name of the guy who wrote it. It'll come to me. But anyway, the book is called Denial of Death. I don't agree with, it's kind of psychoanalytical. There's a lot of psychobabble in it. It was written by an author who ironically wrote this book, published it, won, I believe, a Pulitzer, and died of cancer, I think. Yeah. He didn't know that he had it when he wrote this book, but then he published the book and he died. But anyway, his kind of theory was that, like, all of modern society is actually fundamentally set up to distract us from the fact that we're going to die.
Of course.
That terror of death is what drives everything. And he takes that farther than I would probably take it.
As we reflect on the impact of mortality on our lives, it's also true of us.
And it's also true of us. If we could not exist.
Well, I agree.
You know, if we were depending on welfare from some other country in order to exist, then I would say that, like, we're not a country anymore. So, you know, take it away and, like, let whatever happens. Let the thing fall apart. And maybe from the ashes, we can build a real country. That would be my take if it was true of us. So.
How did we get. I vehemently agree with you. I don't think I've ever heard it as well put. But I don't think anything you said is radical. I think it's, as you just said, it's the way of human civilization. How do we get to a place where that qualifies as a radical view?
I think it's people have been conditioned that, you know, xenophobia is a great sin. And so I don't know. I don't really understand it because I've never felt it. But for a lot of people, they just feel it feels wrong to them to actually prioritize their own country. It feels unnatural to people, which is crazy. It's bizarre because to me, it's the most natural thing in the world. Like, it should not be controversial to say I care more about my country than I care about anybody else. I care more about the people in my country than I care about anyone else. And the amount that I sort of care about you, it increases the closer you are to me. That's the way people work. So I care the most about my own kids. I care more about my own kids than anyone else. If my kids are in a fire and someone else is in a fire, I'm saving my own kids 1,000 times out of 1,000. If I had to choose between one of my kids and 1,000 other people, I'd save my kid over the 1,000 because that's my, you know, they're my kids. That's my blood. And then, you know, branching out from there, I care about my family, my larger family. I care about from there, my community where I live. And then, you know, this is subsidiarity. And then branching out from there, I care about
concentric circles of obligation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's, that should just be so natural. That's how people work, and that's how everyone works. Like, if I told you, anyone who hears this and thinks that it sounds cruel or something, well, if I came to you and told you that your friend's child died, you would be really broken up, I would assume.
In right? tears, yeah, I would.
You'd be in tears about it. If I came to you and said, you know, just a few minutes ago, a child in China was hit by a car and died, you would say, oh, that's too bad.
It's sad.
And then you would not think about it again.
Correct.
You would move on with your life and never even think about it. Even though that's a child, it's a child. The child died. It's a terrible thing. It's really sad. Objectively, that child in China dying objectively is as terrible as your friend's child dying. But your attachment to that child in China is much less, is basically non-existent. Your obligation to that child is
non-existent. But the idea is that what you're describing is sentimentality, really, and that it's our job as evolved beings to override that false sentimentality with like a clearer moral code.
I don't think it is sentimental. I think it's the opposite. I think the idea that we should...
But do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's what they say.
This is effective altruism, actually. It's like, no, that every human life has equal value, which I think you would agree with as a Christian.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Therefore, our obligation to every human being is identical.
And I, and you're right that they would, so what I'm saying they would call false sentimentality, but that is false sentimentality. This idea that we're citizens of the world and we value everyone the same is a false sentiment. No one actually thinks it. You know, you would save your own child from the fire. Is it because you think your child has more moral worth than anyone else's child? No. Is it because your child dying in a fire is objectively more sad than someone else's child? No. But that's your blood. That's not sentiment. That's your blood. That's your family. But that means something.
But blood doesn't matter. Genetics aren't real.
I think it's the most... It's one of the most real things there is, you know, and it's obligation, you know, it should be inherent. It's instinctual, but it's also, you have an obligation to your child. And then branching out of the concentric circles,
you have
an obligation to your country and you have an attachment. You should have an attachment to your country and a pride in your country. These are your people. This is your history. These are your ancestors. And so that's it. I mean, and to me, it's the most natural thing in the world. And
so nationalism is not really an ideology. It's just like nature. It's just the default position. It's like,
yes, what? It's the natural state of human beings.
The natural state of
it's
human
the natural way that societies are organized. That's all national.
Why is everyone afraid of it and against it?
I think it's. A lot of it is confusion, not understanding what nationalism even is. It's part of the kind of globalist agenda. It's part of this destructive, like I said, a lot of it comes down to destroying the family. And we do that by inverting everybody's priorities.
Yeah.
So that, like, they want to get you to the point where you're more concerned about peace in Ukraine than you are about protecting your own child.
Well, they've absolutely succeeded, by the way.
They have.
I go on social media, which I really try to avoid, but whenever I go on it, and it's all right wingers or whatever they are now, but it's all Trump voters, right, in my feed, they're yelling at each other over mostly about Israel, but also about Ukraine, but about foreign countries. That's what they're mad at. I mean, they're totally obsessed. And by the way, I think it's legitimate to have views on all four. I've got a million views on a million different foreign countries, including those two. But that's their overriding concern. It does seem, I hate the word op, but it does seem like by design, someone has sapped the vital energy from Trump's voting base by convincing them that what's happening in these foreign countries is more important than what's happening in their own. That's what I see. Do you see this?
I do see it. And I don't understand it. I don't understand why how do we get to a point where the dominant conversation in this country is about what's happening in other countries? I don't understand it. I don't understand the people that are obsessively focused on it on either side of it, really.
I agree.
Because...
And can I say, America's role in the world is a different question. Like, we play a role in the world. We certainly have. What's the appropriate role is a question that Americans should be concerned with, because it's our money in the lives of our young men. So, but this is something different. You're saying people's, like, obsession about a foreign conflict between two, like, foreign actors. Is that what you're saying? Or I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, yeah. Obsession with a conflict. Taking any foreign country and making it the centerpiece of our political debates makes no sense to me. And I think people on either side do that.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website, www.podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.